Welcome to Making Movies is Hard, a podcast about the everyday struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Timothy Plain.
And I'm Ulrich Bursell.
Each week we discuss filmmaking topics and give you our point of view on them, not as experts, but as two filmmakers trying to figure it out for ourselves. So guess what, everyone? Ulrich and I just worked together for the second time this year, him as producer, me as director. It was a four-day shoot last week, and I kind of hate to say it, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, me too, man. It was awesome. It was probably more fun than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be stressful,
yeah, me too.
But it was actually a lot of fun.
I think it was mostly fun because we just had a lot of great people surrounding us and people that like to have fun.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't super serious. If everyone was super serious, this would not have been fun, but there's a lot of joking going around and just good attitudes and just good people. So
yeah,
I liked it. I don't typically have this much fun on shoots.
Yeah.
Like the last time I had this much fun was probably Spirit Machine.
Yeah. It was funny because I've never really seen you smile that much on a shoot before. And because on the other things that we do, we're just so stressed for time. We have like one day. We're trying to cram so much into one day, but this was like, you know, everyone's having a blast. I mean, we also had, you know, we had the tools and the resources that we don't have in those other situations. So I think the resources make a big deal, a big difference, you know.
Well, back up for a second, because I think we have to tell everyone that this job that we worked on was a commercial job, and it was a proper commercial job with agency and clients involved. In the past, a lot of the commercials that I've directed for the agency is kind of like they've dropped off a lot of the people that would normally be involved in the process because they're just like, you know what? There's not enough money. There's not enough time. We're just going to consolidate it down to like, you know, two levels of approvals. But we had, I counted at one point in Video Village on set 13 people total from agency and client.
Yeah, sounds about right. And then people, they're calling on the phones to get to approval too, right? So it wasn't like they had to call in to other people in order to get things approved. And I mean, yeah, I don't know. I don't want to like, you know, whatever. It makes sense. Like, and it was fun. And those people are wonderful. And the whole process is fine. I had a great time doing it. I want to do it again. It was awesome. But yeah, it was fun.
Well, this was my biggest shoot as a commercial director.
Yeah, this was my biggest shoot as a producer by far. I mean, no matter what, if it's commercial, movie, anything, as a producer, this is like the biggest thing that I have my name on. And yeah, it was awesome. It was really cool.
While I was on set shooting, what were you doing? Were you on your computer most of the time? Were you talking to the agency and client most of the time? Like, were you just running around just based on what needed to be done?
Doing a little bit of both. Luckily, so our EP was doing a lot of the run in between, you know, client, like agency and set, basically. Like, he was sort of doing that. And then we had another guy who would come and fill in for that. But I did that primarily on one day or one afternoon. That was kind of what I was doing. But then I was always kind of right near them. So I was on my computer or on the phone nearby. So if they did need me to jump in and do that, I could like always just, you know, get off the phone. Like, I was on walkie. So they would always be like, you know, they'd be like, hey, anyone from the agency, like any notes? And then I would see that there was no one there. And then I would just run over and be like, hey, what do you guys think? yeah, but I guess I was on my computer a lot, especially the first 3 days, because like I had to do call sheets, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big thing. And then I was like, yeah, and someone would come up to me and they'd be like, oh yeah, we need to order this piece of equipment from this rental shop, like it's already placed, you need to like set up an account. So I would like be, you know, printing out credit card authorization forms and like doing all that stuff on set and filling out that paperwork and then sending the PA to go get there in time to go get the thing before they close. And then, you know, coordinating that kind of stuff. Oh, we really need a strobe light for this one thing that's coming up this afternoon. Oh, where are we going to get a strobe light? Okay. And then coordinate that, you know, and like make sure that happens. So like just seems
it's funny,
like
the repercussions of probably things that I said on set is like, you know what we need is we need this. And then I have no idea how it happened, but probably a lot of it came to you.
Yeah. I mean, cause there was some things that we never talked about. You know, like actually getting that weren't on the prop list that then we would like, you know, add while we were there. Not a lot. I mean, strobe was probably one of the biggest things, but tons of stuff like that. But I mean, it's really fun problem solving, you know?
Yeah.
And
lots of problem solving.
Yeah. And like a lot of times, like there's a couple of situations where they wanted to solve problems with money, And even my boss, the executive producer, was like, he like approved it. He's like, okay, just spend the $400, whatever. And then I was like, no, let's not just spend $400 if we don't have to. Like, I know we're tight on money. Let's go figure it out. And so then I'd go talk to the facilities manager and then like see if we could, you know, do this thing or put some stuff here overnight or whatever, like expand our footprint a little bit more. And it worked out, and we don't have to hire security for the weekend to watch gear while it stays, you know, outside. So, nice. Yeah, I mean, good job. Yeah, it's like things like that, like, you know, just trying to solve problems without spending money, you know, and because like, yeah, you might think like, oh, it's a big agency job, it's a big client, whatever, but it's a tight budget. Just because it's a big company doesn't mean they're just going to throw you money. You can't just go for overages, you know, like,
yeah,
it's not like, oh yeah, just throw some more money at it. No big deal. It's like, it's a fucking big deal. Like, you have to justify, like, why you're asking for more money, why this wasn't thought of in the first place, you know, and if it comes down to you, if it's like just a mistake you made, then they're not going to give you more money. They're like, that's on you, bro. Like, and they're not going to just like write you a check because you didn't anticipate this one thing with this location that you found and that you presented and that it was your thing. It's like, no, that's your problem. That's not their problem. So, yeah, I mean, it's funny. I think even me too, like before working with a big agency, I've had this whole idea where I was like, oh yeah, they'll cover it. $400. No problem, but it's totally. And I mean, I got that from day one too. Like, cause we were talking about that early on, like, budget and estimated numbers and all these things, and it became really clear really quickly that, like, no, like, you cannot go over budget. You have to get everything under budget as much as possible. And it was like, oh yeah, well, that's the world I live in. That's how I do things anyways. Like, yeah. I'm always trying to get things, like, you give me a number, like, I throw out half that number first and see what happens, and then we work up towards that number, you know. So that's kind of how I did it on my end. And you know, I think the guys appreciated that, you know, and it worked out well. I guess it worked out well. I don't know, man. What else do you want to say about this? I mean,
well, I want to know from you, like, what do you think the pros are for commercial work?
The pros. Well, I mean, geez, if every commercial job was like this, like, I don't know, like there's a lot of pros because the content was great. The concept and the content and what we were shooting was really cool. So I don't think every commercial is that cool, right? Like, that can't be right, Timothy. I don't know. You tell me. Like,
it can't be right. Right.
I mean,
well, I would say one thing that's good about my agency is they do usually come up with really cool concepts.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would say, like, yeah, I know what you mean though. Like, in general, the commercial world can get a little, I don't know what the word is that I'm looking for, but yeah, like, it, things aren't as cool.
A little bland
as it would be in film. You're like, you're definitely like tied to playing very broadly to, you know, a huge audience. And so it's unlike movies where, you know, unless you're working in the studio system, but like, especially on the independent level, you can do almost anything you want just because, you know, it's a movie, you can rate it anything you want. Your audiences can be a small audience, but when you're talking about commercials, you're trying to hit like the broadest number of people. And most of the time, I just feel like clients just don't want to piss anyone off. So you can't really be edgy or cool or anything like that.
Right. Well, it was kind of fun because by the nature of what this was that we were doing, you know, our audience was a little bit smaller than it normally would be just because of the nature of what it was.
Yep.
But I mean, what are the pros? A lot of pros. I mean, great people to work with. You get more time than you normally get. The money is good. Getting paid to
people,
do it is really
people
great.
Get paid proper rates.
Yeah, and being able to not just getting paid myself, but also getting to pay my crew a rate that is fair and isn't a slap in the face is also really nice. You know, like, yeah, we're giving proper, decent rates. Like, we're not lowballing everybody, you know? Although in some cases we still had to, like, you know, in certain departments, we still were asking a lot of people because we worked with like some really high level people who get paid a lot. And so a lot of the people were taking small pay cuts, to work with us. But, you know, but everyone was really cool about it. It wasn't that big. It wasn't like the stuff I do normally where I'm like, yeah, work for half your rate. No, it was more like just like a little bit less than normal, you know?
Right.
But everyone had a great time. And I think the vibe on set, I got a lot of compliments from the crew members and some of the cast about like how the set felt, which made me really happy. Cause like as a producer, it's like that sort of like, I take that responsibility on. Like if the set isn't a happy, smooth, like relaxed set, then that's on me, you know? So it was nice to hear that everyone had a good time and that the set felt good. And then everyone felt that they were taken care of, you know? That's another like phrase that people use is like, oh, you took good care of us. You know, and I heard that from a couple crew afterwards, and I was like, yeah, that feels really good that I took good care of the crew, you know, or that like we as a production company did, you know, that's just really nice because it just means that we did things right. Like we gave them the right information. We fed them well. We, you know, just, you know, we were aware of their needs. Like we weren't just like brushing off like, oh, 5 minutes over, like you don't need to. Yeah, you're not going to charge overtime for that. It's like every time like we went over any, it was always a question like, are you okay? Like, are you going to be fine? Like, sorry to do this to you. You know, that's like kind of the attitude that I came about it. Like, if we were getting near to going over, I'd like approach every crew member and have that conversation, you know?
Yep.
So I don't know. I mean, I think, So I mean, that's not really a pro for the commercial world. That's just like kind of what ended up happening.
Yeah. But what's a con in your head of this kind of work?
Set schedule. Like get being given, like when you start a project, being given the shoot dates already and like having to hit these shoot dates and not really having any wiggle room on the shoot dates. I don't know why commercials are run that way. But luckily enough, I'm getting hired. Pretty sure, like 95 to 99% sure that I'm going to be hired on this next job with this company. And it's the same deal. Like we haven't gotten the job awarded yet, but we already have shoot dates. They're going to, by the time the job gets awarded, let's say if it gets awarded, we'll have our shoot date already handed to us. And it's just like, I mean, I'm sure there's a good reason why they do it that way. And I'm sure certain times there's probably more wiggle room than others, but on this one, we had like almost no wiggle room on shoot dates. But that's just really hard because it basically means that if you're trying to find locations, it's just like, yeah, if the location isn't available that day, then you're fucked, you know? Or it's like, oh, can you do it next week? It's like, no, we have to do it this day for whatever reason. And then same with crew. It's like, yeah, if the crew that you want to shoot with is not available, it's like, well, you got to find other crew, you know? And it's, just, yeah. I wish that there was a little bit more wiggle room around there. I mean, luckily again, like we had like, a month almost like of lead in time, you know? So like that was kind of enough time to like kind of guarantee that most of the things were going to work out and that we had enough time to find a location and stuff. But like after a week of searching for locations and, you know, like, oh, we have to lock by, you know, this day, like coming up, it's like, oh geez, you know, like that's really difficult to do. So I don't know, but that's probably my biggest con. What else do I not like about it? I don't know. That's kind of my only
mostly positive. Then,
yeah, I had a really that's good great. Time. I mean, it's basically like in this instance, it was basically like being able to produce something, with a budget and then getting paid for it as well. And, you know, it made like, cause I, you know, whenever I work on anything, like I always end up putting extra time into it. Like I'm not just working the days that I'm booked for. I mean, every job I've ever done, that's been the case. And, you know, when you do that on a job where you're getting paid, like it just feels a lot better. Like, you know,
right.
Even if you're working extra, it's just like, oh, well, I'm still getting paid like for most of the days I worked. It's just like these 3 or 4 days or whatever, or 5 days, you know, or this overtime, I'm not going to get paid obviously, but it's like, yeah, it's like, it's worth putting in that time. And then I guess also the people that you work with are really important, that like everybody is working so hard. Like you are working really hard. The production company guys that we were working with were working so hard. So I feel like if everyone's working really hard and you're working, cause I can't help but work hard. That's just how I do it. no matter what. So when everyone's on the same level, it feels really good. Like, and those guys were working harder than me in some cases, cause they were also juggling other jobs. And right. I was just like, luckily just able to focus on the one, I almost said the name, the one job we were doing and then just stay focused.
Yeah. For me, the pros are the short timelines, relatively short timelines compared to like a short film or even, yeah, especially for like a feature film. Like it's nice that like in a month you've done a whole project.
Right. Yeah.
Which is fun. And it's like, and because there are like deadlines and everything, you're just like, you're rushing forward and you're just doing it.
Right.
There's no time to be like, oh, we'll shoot next month instead. It's like, nope, we got to shoot this date.
Right.
So that's kind of fun. And I also really like that collaboration on these things is at an all time high because there's so many other people that are as invested in this as me. So like agency and client want this to turn out just as good as I do. So they're like, we're all working together to try to make this the best it can be. Whereas sometimes I feel like on the narrative side of things, you know, there's not as much collaboration in that regard. I know everyone wants to make it good, but it's a different level of collaboration.
Right. Well, on your own short film, it basically just comes down to you wanting it to be really good and you trying to make it as good as possible. And it's like people want to help you, but like they're just not invested in the way that you are. But like, yeah, when it's, you know, yeah, you get client and agency and then like, you know, the executive producers of the production company and everyone who's like, yeah, this is like the most important thing in our lives right now. Or this like, right. We need this to go well or we will get fired by our client, you know, like that kind of thing.
yeah.
Then everyone cares as much as you do. And then like, yeah, it makes the collaboration that much better, you know?
Yeah. So I like that. I like that aspect of it.
Yeah.
And, the cons to me are, I just feel like commercials do have a very limited palette of tone and subject matter. Like you see a lot of commercials take place at like workplaces, especially like offices and, you know, people's homes. And I don't know, it just, I feel the world that commercials live in is a much smaller world than like a feature film or narrative film world.
Right.
And I feel like there's so many shortcuts you have to take that in some ways, the characters and the world that you're creating is very stereotypical a lot of times. And also like the directing style of commercials is like, it's a very different thing than like working with actors on like a dialogue
right.
scene.
Right.
Everything's very fast paced. Like a lot of the takes that we were getting were just meant to be like 3 to 5 seconds long, which is a very different style than like getting a take that might last like a minute.
You know,
you don't have the pacing of it's like much faster. So that's a con to me just because if I do more and more of these commercials, I just know I'll get better and better at doing that stuff. And I won't get better and better at like actually doing like narrative work. Cause narrative work I feel is a different skill and it's a different style of directing.
Oh yeah, totally different. But I mean, there's no reason why you can't be good at both, you know, and turn one side of your brain off and the other side of your brain on, you know? It's interesting because like the directing stuff, like I wasn't really even, you know, because that wasn't what I was doing on this. Like that wouldn't even factor into my pros and cons, you know? But yeah, it became very clear to me through this whole process that like, if I'm going to ever direct a commercial that I'll have to do like some sort of spec job or something first in order to get to that level. Cause I just don't have, like you're saying, the subject matter and the tone is so different. All the stuff that I've done in the film world, the short film stuff is just like not applicable at all to any kind of commercial unless they wanted a horror film commercial, which I mean, almost nobody ever wants ever. And if they did want it, they wouldn't want it to be like the ones I made, you know? So I don't know, but yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I don't know. You've been doing it for so long. This is like my first big budget commercial that I've worked on, you know, as a producer, I should say. So I'm just excited to do more. Like it was just a really fun experience. And, you know, I really brought my game up in a lot of ways, you know, and it is interesting because it also reminded me that like the way I work, like is already at that level. It's just like I haven't really been working in those kinds of things. I've just been doing it in smaller things, you know. So because like I didn't really do anything that different in this job, you know, that made it my working worthy of this big budget thing. It was just like, oh, that's just what people will do anyway. So
right,
yeah.
And that's like that kind of brings us to the next topic, because I feel like there's sometimes feels like there's this divide between professionals and like people that aren't like in that place yet. And I just feel like there's not as big of a divide as people probably think that there is. Cause I agree. I feel like even though this was the biggest job I've ever done, I didn't do anything differently than I've ever done on anything. So let's talk about the Filmmaking Sucks podcast. So we had Lindsay Serrano on for episode 104, She's a listener of the show, but she also has her own podcast with her husband, Manny, called Filmmaking Sucks. And after she came on our show and talked on episode 104, they talked a little bit about us. And it was interesting to hear them talk about our podcast and who we were from their point of view after listening to like, 100 episodes. And I felt like there's some things I wanted to respond to because I think they tend to think of us like, oh, we're professionals, so we're different than them. But I don't think so at all. Like, I feel like my 9-to-5 agency job is the same thing as any 9-to-5 job. And I know it sounds like it's really close to the film industry because I'm working in production and I'm like producing TV commercials. But at the same time, it's still just a job and it's still far away from where I feel like I want to be. So to me, it doesn't feel like that I'm like some awesome professional and I'm like so far ahead of somebody who just is like working, let's say, an accounting job.
Yeah, but you do have like being in the building that you're in, having the job that you have, like you do have like a certain level of status that other people inside the filmmaking community don't have. You know, by being a producer at the company that you're at, I don't know if you want to say what company it is, but, you just kind of have like this experience level that most other producers don't have, you know, like I don't really know any other producers who have like produced the level of spots that you have, you know? So it's sort of, it definitely is different, but at the same time, you're right. Like, cause like being on set on this big job and just doing my thing. Yeah. It wasn't like I was doing anything wrong by doing things the way I do with my indie background or whatever, mm-hmm. or like by working the way that I like to work. It was actually like people really liked the way I worked a lot and they really appreciated it. And my attitude like was really appreciated by people. And, you know, I'm just going to toot my own horn here a little bit, just, whatever. But, we had this VTR, operator come from LA, to do our job. And, he came the day before he was on set and he like unloaded his equipment and stuff. And like I sort of just gave him the tour of the place, like told him what we're doing, showed him everything, blah, blah, blah. And he was just like, yeah, man, like, wow, like this is great. Like, you know, I come on a job in LA and like they just like point and yell at me and they're like, over there. And I'm like, figure it out. And then they ignore me. But like you like gave me a tour. I was like, oh, man, I really appreciate that. And then someone else said something about like, you know, just the amount of, you know, information that you give or you gave or the way that you conducted yourself was just really nice. Cause like not, you don't usually get that kind of level of communication and level of transparency when you're on a job. Usually you just get like the scripts the same day or whatever. But like, you know, I was like coordinating with the makeup artist and with the wardrobe artist, like making sure they had all the information they needed. So they were like able to do their job well. And like, yeah, they just like really appreciated it. And I was like, oh, awesome. Well, that's cool. Cause that's the way I like to do things. And that just worked out well for this big budget job. And I don't know. So I guess what I'm trying to say, bring it all back around, is that, yeah, I think you're right. There isn't really that much difference between, you know, that world and the smaller budget indie world stuff. It's just, you know, you just feels that way when you're like, you know, working on your little short film that like, you know, you're just paying for out of your pocket or whatever. And like, you're like, oh, I don't barely know what I'm doing. I'm just making it happen. But then, you know, you turn around and you go on a job, you do the same thing. And then it's like, oh, wait, this is just how people work. And it's totally fine. And there's no big, you know, there isn't really that much of a difference between me and like the bigger level producers or whatever. So,
right. And the way you solve problems, I feel, is the same too. It's like, yeah, when you have no money, you're like begging for, you know, favors and you're asking people for help. Like, I need a house for like 2 days to shoot at and you don't know where you're going to find that house. And you just ask around and you find stuff. I think the same thing applies when you have more money too. It's like you don't always have the solution. You can't always throw money at things. Like sometimes you just have to like kind of like ask around at the contacts that you know and like find something. Yeah. Like how did you find the place that we shot at? Like how did that come about?
So our
we didn't have a location scout. Like we did all the scouting ourselves.
Well, our production coordinator before I started had put together a list of all the like different places in the Bay Area that he thought might work. And so my first day of the job, I just started calling them first thing Monday morning and just asking if I could come by and talk about shooting a video at their place. Really, the way it was able to get those locations and that location was just by being there in person, having a straight to face conversation with the right person at the brewery the brewery in this case, but or the location that, you know, we wanted. And like, I think just having that connection and just talking face to face to somebody and being very transparent on what you're doing, I think that helped a lot. And obviously I didn't tell them what it was for until they signed, just because that was part of the deal, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think just being really open of like what your needs are and what you're looking to do, I think that really helps.
And was that any different from when you negotiated the location for a very low budget music video?
No, the same.
It's the same deal.
I mean, I think for that one, they do rentals. So it was different because like I just had to go through their rental process. But I mean, I basically, you know, I got a 50% discount on that location, which was like, yeah, pretty awesome.
It's easy to think of professionals as like playing in a different field than you, but it's actually all the same thing. Right. It's all the same kind of problem solving. And then, you know, just sometimes you have money that you can spend in places. But for a lot of times, I feel like we're solving problems the same way that we would do on our indie films.
Yeah.
Like that location example, I think, is a perfect example of that. And I'm sure we could come up with a bunch of other ones. But I guess the thing I just wanted to reiterate to anyone who's coming over from the Filmmaking Sucks podcast and listening to us, or anybody else who's listening and being like, oh, well, you know, those guys are at a different level. They're professionals. Like, I don't see it that way. And I don't feel like I'm a professional.
Right.
Like, I mean, I don't look at myself and be like, I'm a professional. I feel like I'm still struggling to make a name for myself and still struggling to like get my footing and to prove myself. Like, I feel like every job feels like it's my last job.
Right.
Like, this could be it. Like, this might be my only chance. And then after this, it's just going to go away. So I don't feel like there's any security in that I'm getting paid for what I'm doing right now. I feel like it could all go away at any moment.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that way too. Like, you never, but the thing that I've been thinking about a lot, and especially since, cause before this big job, like, I wasn't really working all that much. Like, you know, I had a couple good weeks, like, you know, shoot here, shoot there, little editing work, whatever, but it was a little dry for me. And then this thing just kind of, and then that's kind of like, I had decided, okay, I'm going to put all my energy into my short films or my feature films. I'm going to do kind of like what Lindsay was talking about and just buckle down and get the numbers lower and just try to make it happen. And then this job happened, and then it's like, oh my God, now, you know, whirlwind. And now, you know, I have a little time off, and now it's going to just, I'm trying to get right back to the same thing. Like, back to the feature films, like back to scrounging, like getting the budgets lower, whatever, whatever. But like, even in this big job, like, I was still asking for favors. Like, you know, it wasn't just like, oh yeah, I have all the money in the world. Like, everything I asked for was a favor still, you know. Most of the crew got paid really well, so that wasn't a favor, but they're still asking things of them that was outside of their budget, you know. Like, there was always more, you know, because we just didn't have even though we had money, we still didn't have enough money, and we still didn't have enough prep days for everybody. We didn't have enough of this or that. I mean, art department, like, he probably is going to end up getting paid like, you know, like less than $100 a day when you break it all down, you know. And like, he's like, yeah, he worked on Star Trek, like, you know. So I feel like it's interesting, because like, I listened to the Lindsay's podcast with Manny also, and just the way that they talked about us, it was so funny. Like, the way they were talking about the podcast, it was like we're like celebrities or something. It's like, you know,
we're just like them. Yeah. They're actually ahead of us. They're making feature films.
Yeah. And it was funny because they're kind of, you know, come from a world that I saw a little bit of when I was touring with Strange Thing, when I got to play those 20 film festivals and I was going all around the country to these different places. And it's like, they're like part of that world more than I am. Or, you know, well, I'm not really part of it now at all, because I don't really have a movie in festivals, but that's their world, you know, like this indie, low budget, like horror, sci-fi feature world. And like, that's a world I like would love to be a part of, you know. But I just need to make a movie. But it's like, they're saying, oh yeah, you can just do it. Take $20,000, take $10,000, just make a movie. But it's like, when you have a certain vision of what you want to achieve, and like, you know what it takes to make something look a certain way, it's like, you just want to get the right amount together to do it, you know? And so,
okay, well, let's set this up, because that's my next point on this is, the reason I feel like we're unable to think about our movies in a micro budget realm is not because we're not resourceful, not because we can't figure things out how to do it for little to no money, but I think there's other obstacles to it. And so keep going. So yours is, you see it a certain way in your head and you don't think you can pull it off. If what?
Yeah. because like I want to shoot with a certain type of crew, right? And I want to have a team with me. And I mean, I could make this movie. Like I'm thinking about like, okay, what's the smallest amount of team I need to make a feature, right? Like, do I need 5 people? Do I need 6 people? Do I need 10 people? Do I need 12 people? Like, I think in a perfect world, I would make my movie with 20 people. Like a 20-person crew would be like exactly what I want. But like to get a 20-person crew, you need like, you know, like you got to pay them something. You can't like for 15 plus days or whatever, you can't get them to do that for free. Like, it's just not okay with me. It's not going to be okay with them. So like, that's like, they're just like getting favors is what they, Manny and Lindsay say, like, get favors. Like, well, just to get like a 20-person crew to work for 15 days at $200 a day, let's say, like, that would be a humongous favor from all those people. So, I mean, we're definitely getting favors, even if we have to pay, but just getting, $200 a day for a 20-person crew at 15 days, I think that's already like $80,000 or something like that.
So it would be, okay, 20-person crew times $200 each times 15-day shoot?
Yeah. What is that?
That just for the crew itself is $60,000.
Yeah. And then you have to feed them, right? And
you have to feed them. You have to get a location. You have to get
right.
props, wardrobe.
But like just feeding them, because like the other stuff, props, wardrobe, like you can schmudge that, right? Like you can spend very little on those things, like right. by borrowing things, getting things for free. If you have some special effects, that's going to need a little bit of money, you know. But you're already at $60,000 if you're just going to pay a 20-person crew. They'll probably say, you don't need 20 people. You can do it over less. Like, as well, like
that's what they would say. They don't, you need it. Or they would say pay them less than that or have them work for free.
You can't do that.
Why not?
I just think... Well, for me, at this point, to work with the crew that I want, like, I've already done that to them 3 times, maybe 4 times, depending on who it is. But, like, most of them, I've already had them work for, like, 3 days, two 3-day shoots for free. And then I think the first one, actually, I paid them a little bit. But the second one was definitely for free for 3 days. And then I had another one that was for free. Like, you can only ask people to work for free for so much before I feel like it's just the right thing to do to pay them, you know? And so that's kind of where I'm coming from with that. I mean, yeah, you could probably like 10-person crew would still be pretty good. That's $30,000. That's not so bad. But that's still not $10,000 or $20,000. I think in order to make a movie for $10,000 to $20,000, I would literally have to have like a 3-person crew or 4-person crew maybe. And then just do it that way. I think, so
that's,
you know,
great.
If I had the right movie, I could do that. If I had the right script, I just, right now, I don't feel like I have the right script to do that kind of movie, you know?
Well, what would the alternate look like with a 4-person crew?
I don't think you could do it because the amount of work in order to get the sets, to be the right way would just be, would be crazy. You know, like, cause you have to have an office that looks one way half the time and looks another way the other half of the time. So in order to reset the office, like the whole crew would have to drop everything and just do that work. You know, like we would just have to reset it. That would probably be like, you know, whatever, 2 hours of our shooting day to do that. It just feels like you just need an art department in a movie like that, you know? You don't need one. It would be better to have one. I mean, I guess I could do it all by myself, right? But it just seems like, you know, getting the art department, getting the team together for this kind of movie, if you want it to turn out a certain way and you want to have a certain amount of time to tell the story and a certain amount of your brain that you can focus on the story, that's sort of why I'm looking at this movie in the way I am, and I'm trying to raise the money in the way I am for this one.
This is where I think our professionalism gets in our way, in that we're used to working a certain way, and we've had the luxury of being like this shoot that we just did, where like I didn't have to do anything but direct.
Yeah.
You know? And then you think about that, and you like think about the quality of thinking and how much better the stuff turns out, and then you go, well, I want to do that on my movie. Like, I don't want to have to do like 10 different jobs. I want to just direct.
Right.
And so then I think there's two things that I think are holding me back from like really hitting that micro budget level. It's like, one, it feels like going back to a model that I'd never really liked shooting in, that, and the results never turned out great for me. And then two, like negotiating rates that I just think are unrealistic. To pay crew $100 a day, which is kind of what I'm seeing on some of the micro budgets that I've been working on in the past few months. Just like finding those people to work for $100 a day, you're really asking people that are not very experienced. So then you're like adding not experienced crew onto an already like thin production. And then it's just like, it gets really scary. And I guess that's what it is. It just gets scary. And it's not like it's not doable, and it probably is. And I think, you know, part of what's probably holding us back is just, you know, we want it to be a certain way. And, you know, we probably will just have to get desperate enough to give up on that certain way of doing things to just be like, fuck it. I'm just going to just go make it. And use people that are less experienced. I mean, Richard Bosner brought this up too, where like the person he hired to produce his film was like, you know, didn't have the experience producing a film of that caliber, but he gave him a chance.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and I don't have any problem with that, but it's just like, you know, I think there's certain projects that you're willing to do that for and certain projects you're not. Like there's a friend of mine's writing this movie that he's been working on for a couple of years, and he shared it with me. He's got like about halfway through, and it's like a hostage movie. You know, very few actors, like one location mainly. It's like, yeah, like let's do, like I would totally do that with like a 5 to 6 person crew or whatever, or however little people as possible, you know? I think maybe one of the reasons why is because it's not my movie. So, it's not my script, but I mean, I like it a lot, but it's actually, that's not really why. It's not because of that. It's because I like reading the script, I can have a vision in my head of how to make this movie with 5 people. That's why it works.
Right.
But like when I look at the alternate, like the vision in my head is like, I try to imagine it with 5 people and I can't see it turning out well with 5 people. I just see it as being a disaster with 5 people. And when you're putting something forward and you're spending your own money and it's something that's so important to you, it's like, yeah, like, or the money that you've like, you spent so hard, so much time, like just raising just a little bit of money from people, you know, getting a little bit of money in the bank. It's like, I cannot, like just blow it on something that, you know, I can't see it working out well, you know, but if I like close my eyes and I look at the movie that I've written and the script I have or the script that's delivered to me and I see it being made, in this fashion with a small crew and it being good, let's do it, you know? So it's just, for me, it's like having the right project that will work with that kind of style of super low budget filmmaking. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I agree with you. I think, you know, as a professional, you work in a different way. You have a different setup and you have a different experience. And I think we're just saying, like, based on the experience that we've had with our films and our professional work, we want to do it a certain way to achieve the results that we want. And if we didn't, for me, I'm not going to talk for you, I guess. For me, if I can't do it in a way that I'm confident the product's going to turn out well, I'd rather not do it at all. Because the worst thing for me would be to like go spend $30,000 and come out on the other end with a movie that I didn't want to show anyone because I'm just too embarrassed about
it. Right, exactly.
So yeah. I'd want to go in. If it is a $30,000 movie and it is, and the way to get it done is working with people that aren't that experienced and it's like a 5-person crew, I would just want to go into that knowing like, that's okay, because like we'll take advantage of that, or I feel like these people aren't that experienced but they're super talented, or you know, whatever it is, I feel confident that we can make something great.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I feel like, you know, we're saying the same thing basically.
We are.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's the same way I'm thinking about it. And it's interesting, like you're listening to their podcast and they're like, yeah, like you got to make your own blood and you got to do this own thing and you got to like go out and just like, you know, do it all yourself. And it's like, we've all done that, you know? And I did it recently on that little short that I shot in one day, that cake movie thing, you know, where like I spent like $100 and I made a short film, you know, cause I'm trying to retrain myself back to that lower budget level. So I still have that low budget muscle there that I can use for the feature stuff. Cause yeah, trying to raise money, even as people like us who have made, you know, short films that were expensive and have this experience behind us, like, yeah, it's not easy to raise money, you know, like no one wants to give you money if you haven't already made a movie, you know, that's sold and done well. So I think we do have to go and figure out how to do it for less. But I mean, at the same time, I think there's nothing wrong with trying to get $100,000 or plus together to make your first feature, because, you know, we should be able to raise that amount of money. Like, you know, I mean, no, that's a lot. I don't even know if I'm going to be able to raise it, but I think I should be able to raise it to do it, you know.
I guess the last question on this topic before we move on is, like, why have neither of us made our feature film yet?
Yeah. I think it's because, yeah, I think the reasons that we said, right? Like, the scripts that I have so far that are done, I don't think I could make confidently for under, 100, whatever, 100,000 plus, 100 plus thousand dollars, you know? And if I had that script that I felt confident in, that I could make for 50,000 or under, which is, I'm getting close to having that, then I'll go out and do it, you know? But I think that's sort of what's been standing in my way from making my first feature. And also, we've talked about this too, but there's this whole thing about, like, you know, the gravitas that your first feature has and the importance behind your first feature. And, like, you know, like, you never get another first feature, you know, so you want your first feature to be special and good. Like, and Rob Rickert, this is a conversation we've had multiple times. This is how he feels. Like, he's like, I was like, hey, we're talking about this situation. Like, I think somebody had offered to let him direct a movie, like a low budget movie, like 100,000 or something like that. And it didn't end up happening, but he was like, well, I was like, well, would you do it if you had the chance? He's like, yeah, I'd probably do it, but, I would do it under a pseudonym because I don't want that. Like, if it's not my own baby that I wrote, my own project that, like, I'm passionate about, I don't want that to be my first feature that's out into the world. You know, I want to save my first feature for something that's important to me.
I think that's bullshit, though.
Really?
Yeah, because you, like, look at the start of a lot of, like, big directors. I think, like, Oliver Stone did something for Roger Corman, and, you know, James Cameron did Piranha 2. It's like, those are shitty movies. Like, no one cares about them. They're not in the canon of those, like, great directors. People know that they did them, but it's not, like, what they're known for. No one goes back all the way to Piranha 2 and be like, let's see how James Cameron got a start. They're starting a Terminator.
Yeah, but I think, like, you know, it's more of modern filmmakers like Tarantino with Reservoir Dogs or help me out here. So what's some other examples of modern filmmakers who, like, their first feature was insane? Like Rodriguez, even with, you know, El Mariachi. People love that movie, you know?
I know, but at the same time, that kind of thinking can definitely paralyze you from ever making the start because you think about those people, they're like the 1% of all movies that got made that year, and they were the breakout successes. But the chances that we're going to have a breakout success are very slim. So I think if you're holding yourself up to that standard, it's kind of like holding your career up to the Steven Spielberg standard. Right. Most of us are just never going to get there. Right. So I think there's like a balance. Like, I don't want to just make a feature just to make a feature, but I also don't want to make a feature to be Reservoir Dogs, because I think both sides of that are dangerous. Like, one is, if you don't care enough about it, it's not going to turn out well. And if you care too much about it, you might paralyze yourself from ever pursuing it. So you have to kind of find a middle ground. Is like, I believe in this enough that I think I can do something good with it. Whether or not it's going to be a huge breakout success doesn't matter. It's more about, like, you know, proving my skills as a director and, like, just getting something off the ground.
Right. I also think that, you know, just getting good at directing a feature, like, you need to direct a feature in order to kind of get your chops. Like, you can't really expect yourself to be Tarantino or Rodriguez or whoever on your first
feature. Blue Ruin.
That wasn't even his first feature. Like, he did one before that.
There you go.
Which wasn't very good. I mean, I didn't actually watch the whole thing. It was just dark. Beth maybe turned it off because it was too disturbing for her. But yeah, you know, anyways, it wasn't Blue Ruin. Let's put it that way. But which just makes sense. Like, you know, your first feature, of course, you're gonna get practice. You're gonna get better. So
it's just like doing your first short film. It's not gonna be great. It might be okay. It might turn out good. But it's really about getting confidence to go out and do it again. And I would say, like, the first feature is not a throwaway thing, but it is. You have to definitely look at it as practice. And I really like how Rodriguez approached El Mariachi, where he didn't think anything was going to happen with it. He just wanted to, like, get it out of his system and then move on to the next one. And it just, the whole success of that movie was an accident.
Right.
And so I think we've been saying this since the beginning of the podcast. You can't think about the success.
Right.
If you think about the success, you're going to kill you, because the chances that any of us are going to succeed at our first feature, movie making at all is very, very slim. So you just have to put that to the side and just do the best with what you have.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I don't know if we're ready to wrap this section up, but I was just going to say, like, to Lindsay and Manny, like, yes, you're right. We need to, you know, go smaller, think about how to, like, you know, make our movies for less money and not, you know, treat it like a commercial job every time. But at the same time, you know, what we're doing and what you're doing isn't that much different. So don't really, I don't think you should think about yourselves as us as professionals and you as amateurs, because it's almost like what you're talking about, like, you guys have more experience in the narrative world than we do in a lot of cases, because, you know, we've both only done, like, you know, a handful of short films and no features, and you've done probably as many short films and features. So it's like you're kind of the professionals in the narrative world, and we're like the amateurs, and then, you know, we're like the professionals in corporate video commercial world, you know, but that they're very different. They're the same, but very different at the same time. So,
yeah. And I guess the final thought on that is, like, professional, you can just define as like, oh, you're getting paid for, you know, that skill. I would just go, you know, one step further and just say, it's not about getting paid. It's about your experience and, like, having the experience of doing it over and over again, whether you get paid or not. You guys have way more experience than we do. So, like, Ulrich's right. You guys are the professionals in the narrative world, and we're just out here, like, putting around with commercials and corporate videos and some short films and trying to get to where you guys are. And we're having a hard time doing it because I think Lindsay is right that our professional lives is definitely, like, making the side projects harder to pull off, because we want to work with certain crew members that we don't think we can negotiate for less than $200 a day. And as soon as you get there, or you add in the number of crew members you want to use, and it just, you know, it balloons very fast.
Yeah. Or you don't even feel like it's right to ask them to work for less than $200 a day, that it's like,
right,
we should be lucky to get them for $200 a day. And it's like, that's the right way to do it, you know, is to raise the money and pay people.
With, you know, Lindsay and Manny, like, they're lucky that they're not in the film world, because they can ask people to work for free or for little money and get their movies made for less. And we're stuck in a place where all of our connections in the film world are professionals, and so they're expecting a certain rate. And so to negotiate them less than $200 a day or to use less crew, it's like you ask a gaffer, like, how many people you need. And then that gaffer is going to be like, oh, I need like six people to pull this off. And you're like, right, well, you only get one. And they're like, well, I'm not in then.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, that's also part of the struggle with us too, is like the people that we have connections to are great and they're really talented and they're professional, but they also cost a lot of money.
Right. And not necessarily because they want more money, but it's because they want more tools. They want, like you're saying, more people,
right,
more
everything. That's how they're used to working.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, I recently had a conversation with my gaffer, and I was like, what is the smallest amount of people you would do a feature with me for? Like, what's the smallest crew? And I think he basically said, like, a key grip. Like, if it's him and a key grip, then he would do it. But we will not do it by himself, you know? So, yeah, I mean, well, which is reasonable. But I mean, that's way better than what I thought he was going to say. I thought he was going to be like, it needs to be at least four. It's like, you can't do that. It's just too many people. Yeah,
we'll keep trying to figure it out. And I'm sorry, Lindsay and Manny, that we're frustrating you with talking about making a feature every week and we still haven't done it yet. But we promise we will do it.
We're getting close.
We're getting closer.
Feels good. Timothy is about to make his feature before I make my feature. That's how I feel. Anyways, one last thing about this. Just, people listen to Filmmaking Sucks because it's a cool podcast. I hadn't listened to it before, but just listening to the first 20 minutes or so, it's really cool. And I think it's nice because it is filling a niche that we aren't filling, because they do talk about, you know, they're addressing a different audience. They're addressing, like, the 9-to-5ers who work at works a day job that isn't in the film industry and who are making movies. So I feel like those people, you know, and people who are just getting started, who want to just know the basics, like, that, it's going to be a really great resource. So people should check it out.
So who are we talking to?
We're talking to everybody. We're talking to, those people, if they want to listen, if they're interested. And then we're also talking to, like, the working filmmakers who are actually making movies, who are way ahead of us. And we're talking to people like us who we see on sets who are also trying to get their movies made and trying to take the next step in their careers. So we're talking to everybody. But it's just a slightly different tone and different vibe, I think.
We're like somewhere in between filmmaking sucks and just shoot it.
Right, somewhere. The one thing that was really funny, I don't know if you remember this, but I think Manny was saying, they were saying like, you know, I don't want to say like Michael Bay should listen to this podcast, but Michael Bay should probably listen to this podcast. I'm like, oh, that's really cool that, you know.
Yeah, I never thought that we'd have value for anybody that was like beyond where we were.
I would really wonder what Michael Bay or someone like that would have to say about what we're talking about. They'd be like, what the fuck?
He'd be like, what a bunch of pussies.
What a bunch of losers.
Moved to LA already.
Why are you in LA? What do you think? You're a professional?
So to continue on with the professional theme of this podcast, we have a few listener reviews, and one of them has a question in it that I'd like to answer in detail. We started answering this with one of our listeners in episode 104, but I think we can go into a little more depth. So you want to read the first one, and then I'll read the second one?
Sure. So this podcast is My Film School Handbook by Andrew B45 on June 27th. In college film school, there's a lot that you'll learn about equipment and movie theory that's all important and great. But in a classroom context, you are so isolated from the reality of independent filmmaking and really need someone to set your expectations straight. This podcast is not only entertaining, but it bridges gaps between my own limited perspective and knowledge and where I want to be several years down the road. 5 stars. Thank you so much, Andrew. That's awesome.
I like that because it's true. I remember film school did not prepare me at all for the real world. Took a lot of book learning and theory, and then it takes like years in the industry to kind of like figure out like how things are actually done and what's expected of you.
Right. Yeah, totally.
And to find out that everyone's just sad.
well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on which what project. Like, I think I worked on some where, yeah, people were pretty down and like not so happy, but I worked on others where people are super happy. So it just sort of depends on what what level or what type of project you get on, you know. So what's okay, this next one?
The next one, that's also sounds like it's from a film school student. So the subject is awesome job. 5 stars by Huge Mungus. Hey guys, I just want to say you're doing a great job. I'm a director from Tampa Bay area, and I just want to say that everything you explain is incredibly inspiring. I know you guys are in the triple digit episodes, but I started this podcast at episode 1 and I'm working my way through. I'm not sure if you'll do a mention of this review in an episode, but if you do, I'm excited to hear. I have a question for you guys that I would like for you to answer, if you haven't already. But my question is this. After you graduated from college, what was your next step towards film? Did you have a plan immediately after or just before you graduated? Also, how did you meet the right people to push your projects through? Being a soon-to-be college graduate who goes to a school without a film program, my constant worry is not knowing exactly what to do next, and I would like to hear what you guys did after you finished school. Thanks, guys. I appreciate all that you do. Keep up the great work. R.C. Gates.
Wow, awesome. Well, thanks for listening, R.C. And, yeah, Timothy, let's answer this question.
Well, I had no idea what I was going to do when I graduated film school. It took me 4.5 years to go through the film program at the Academy of Art, and with a year and a half of school left, I decided I didn't want to do filmmaking anymore. And I actually asked my parents if it was okay if I drop out. I was like, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm happy working a 9-to-5 job, which at the time I was working at a machine shop. I was just putting like pieces in a collet and pressing a button on a machine for like 8 hours a day and just watching this computer just like mill on parts. And I was like, this is great. Like, what's wrong with just like living a regular 9-to-5 job, and on the side I'll do some writing. Like, that's, I was so like funny. Totally happy just to do that. At that time I wanted to be a novelist. So I was just like, you know, work a regular job, write on the side. You know, that sounds like a pretty awesome life. So when I graduated out of college, I just like was looking for any 9-to-5 job. And I think actually at the time I was kind of interested in video games. So I think I was like searching around trying to find a video game job or maybe a job in in publishing, you know, whatever I could find that sounded kind of interesting. But the market had crashed when I graduated and there was no jobs. So it took me, I think, 4 months to find a job. I was newly married. There's a lot of pressure just to like kind of figure things out. And I just ended up just like getting a regular job at a sailboat company and sticking it out there for like 2.5 years and writing on the side and thinking that I was going to become a novelist.
Nice. Wow.
And then it took me like around two years of that job before it was like kind of woke up to the fact that I didn't belong in that world, that I needed to be around creative people. Because what I didn't think about when I was like had this whole dream of like I'll just work kind of like 9 to 5 is that the people that you're surrounded with aren't inspiring. You know, they're just kind of living their lives, and they weren't writers, you know, they weren't filmmakers, they weren't creative people, and that was really getting to me. And so I wanted to be around creative people, and that's when I started looking for another job.
Wow.
But still, I mean, the same thing. Like, I still wasn't interested in film. I think I was looking at video game jobs. I remember when I interviewed at the agency I work at now, they asked me, like, you know, if you could do anything, you know, if you could make your dream job, what would it be? And I was like, probably working at, like, Sega.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it took me a long time to get back into filmmaking. And so, like, I graduated in 2000, and I didn't start making films again until end of 2005. So almost six years out of school before I started getting into film. And so, you know, that's about 10 years ago. And it took me 10 years from the point I started making films to now, like, getting commercial projects.
Wow.
At my agency. Like, when I first started working in the production department at my agency, like, I wasn't producing big budget TV commercials. I wasn't directing anything crazy. I mean, it was just kind of like homemade videos. I was shooting on like a DV camcorder in 4:3, no lights, just me shooting people and editing on my laptop and Final Cut Pro, and, you know, just making silly little videos. And it took me a long time to kind of build up to the level where now I'm like working with proper crews. So, you know, between college and now, it's been 17 years. Taking me this long to kind of like get to this place.
Have you ever talked about what your first job at the agency was before you became a producer?
Yeah, I think I did, probably.
It's such a great story.
So, like, I was working at the sailboat company, and I was just like searching Craigslist for jobs, and I saw this job posting for a facilities manager, which I didn't know much about it, but it, you know, the job description sounded pretty straightforward. Like, you're calling the plumber when the toilets get broken. You're helping clean conference rooms. You're helping people move from office to office and managing the phone system. Like, anything that has to do with the building was what the job was. And so I went in to interview at this place, and I walk in, and there's all these trophies like in the reception area. And I was like, what is this place? It's like, and I had gone to their website, and their website was really crappy. It just had like a few like print ads on it. Like, one of them was for Porsche, I remember. And I was like, it was like a whole different world that I'd never even knew existed. Like, advertising, I knew there was advertising out there, but I didn't really know anybody that worked in there. So walking into this place for the first time was just kind of like, okay, like, these people are legit, but I've never heard of them. I don't know how this business works. And the interview went really well. Like, I actually like left my sailboat job to go take this interview during lunch, and it took like hours to interview with everyone, and I had to like come back to work and pretend like I fell asleep during my lunch break.
Wow, crazy.
So I got the job, and yeah, my job for 2.5 years at the agency was you know, fixing printers and the phone system and moving people from office to office, calling the plumber, you know, whatever needed to be done, like building maintenance style. And even at that time, like, I wasn't like doing that in the hopes that I'd be able to move to any other department. I was just like happy to be in a creative place. Like, everyone was so awesome. Like, it was like so much fun to be around all these people that were like making art, not advertising. Like, they were doing things outside of work that was really fun. There's like painters, there's filmmakers, there was writers. And so, like, to be friends with all these people was really cool. And like, that's what inspired me to get back into filmmaking, was I realized that there's a community of people that weren't dicks and assholes that that did want to make stuff that I wanted to make too.
Yeah, that's so funny. That just briefly reminds me of my first ever film class, and just everyone was so pretentious in the film class, like including the teacher and not just the students. And I was like, fuck this. I'm not going to be in this stupid ass major with these fucking pretentious ass people. This is bullshit. And so that's why, like, I had already been signed up for the broadcasting major at SF State. So then I just stayed in it and didn't leave. And I took one, the intro to film class or whatever. And then I took one intro to broadcasting class. And then the intro to broadcasting class, they start the class by having a video from, you know, the two guys from Frasier, David Hyde Pierce and Kelsey Grammer. And they do like a direct introduction to the SF State broadcasting, you know, like freshman or whatever it is. And cause like the guy who started that show was a broadcasting major, at SF State. So like he got them to do this special intro to those students. And then that's what they play at the start of like the intro to broadcasting for the students. So like that sort of thing. And that teacher was awesome. So that video, that teacher and that intro class versus the filmmaking intro class or whatever class I took, it was like, easy choice, right? So that was sort of why I stayed in that major.
But it's true. That's the way I felt in film school also, is that people just seem so pretentious and I just didn't really get along with people. And there's so many times in film school where I had to just do everything myself because no one wanted to help me. And I was like, this is dumb. Like no one wants to collaborate. I thought film was all about collaboration. I was really frustrated that the stuff that I wasn't making looked the way that I wanted to. I just didn't feel like I was like cut out for filmmaking. So I just gave up on it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I feel like in a lot of ways I got a really late start because I didn't graduate film school with a plan. I didn't graduate film school and jump right into the filmmaking industry. It took me 9 years out of school before I produced like a TV commercial.
Yeah, but like but where you are is at such a bigger level than most people that I know, you know? So I think your roundabout route led you to something pretty amazing.
Yeah. But you know, like when Steven Bernstein was on the podcast and he said like, you know, so much of your career is based on arbitrary decisions, like I completely relate to that. Mm. Like everything that's happened in my life has just been an arbitrary decision.
Right.
You know, it's like I didn't set out to get a job at the agency to move up into the production department to then like start pursuing directing. It's just kind of like these little decisions that have been made and like created this path for me. And I ended up in San Francisco at an advertising agency and I'm really just trying to make the most out of it that I can. And I've always been really stubborn about not wanting to start at the bottom. Like, I think your story is more about, like, you started PAing. I never wanted to do that.
You're right.
Like, I was like, I remember in film school just being like, if I can't start from the top, I don't want to start at all.
Right. Well, it's interesting that's the way it worked out for you because you are kind of like at the top, you know,
trickling down.
Commercial world. Yeah. No. But it's funny that, like, you got to where you are without doing the PA thing where, like, I think a lot of people, you know, did do the PA thing to get where they are. But it's like, it's funny, the people that we're working with on this commercial, a lot of them didn't have to do that because they just took different routes to get to where they were, you know, or where they are now. But yeah, should I talk through what I did after school and all that stuff?
Yeah, just one last thing that I'm just going to say, just like for anyone who's listening, and this happens every time you hear somebody's stories, like you think, like, maybe you think, oh, that's the kind of path that I want to take. And like, maybe I should go into advertising and I'll work my way through it. I don't think that you can plan these things. No. I think it's really hard to plan a career path. And that's what I found out when I graduated college and I had all these dreams and ambitions and the market crashed and I didn't have any real choice in what job I was going to take. Like the two job choices that I had was a receptionist at a real estate company or a sales agent at a sailboat company. And like, those were my choices. Like, and I had all these dreams about like, I'm going to work in publishing or I'm going to work for like a comic book place or I'm going to work for Sega, you know, like all these things that I wanted to do, like just didn't happen because at the time that those opportunities weren't available to me. So as much as you want to plan things and as much as you might want like to make your path a certain way, you know, it is going to come down to luck and timing and like what is available and what those opportunities are. And my advice to people is like, try not to be too stubborn about what path you take and just look for the opportunities. And when you see them, like, you have to jump at whatever opportunity is in front of you and not the opportunity that you think that you hope and dream will exist, because it might just not exist for you at that time.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty good advice.
All right, so let's hear your story. So okay. you're going to college.
Going to college. I started college. This is gonna, yeah, our age difference. I started in 2005 was when I started at SF State, and I was a broadcasting major. So I did that, and like when I was ready to graduate, I had done like 3 internships, like, and I had this internship at the, ABC7 at the View from the Bay. It was an old TV show that doesn't exist anymore. It was like a live to tape variety show, kind of like Good Morning America, it's more like Ellen. It was kind of like the Bay Area Ellen, basically, was what it was, with like 2 newscasters who did this show, once a day, live. So that was like my internship. And basically, when I graduated, it was in the second crash in 2008. So we both graduated at crashes. So they were basically like, yeah, normally we'd be offering you a job because you did such a great job at the internship, but we just fired 4 producers, so we can't hire you, and sorry. So that was like gone. I think I got like 2 or 3 like freelance days from them at like, you know, whatever, like $150, $200 a day or something. But like that was like a pretty much a closed door. So I was like, you know, graduated. It was January. I had like no job. I don't even know how I was paying rent. I think I just maybe was paying rent from what? Oh, I was working at LensCrafters. That's right. So I was working at LensCrafters at the time. And then I think I was still kind of bouncing because I was a bouncer in college. So I think I was still bouncing and I was working at LensCrafters, when I graduated. So that was like how I was paying the bills. But I like basically didn't know. I was like trying to get my foothold in the film world or something, you know? So basically my plan was this, like when I graduated, I was like, okay, like I've got 3 months to get some sort of job in, filmmaking. And if that doesn't work out, then, I'm going to move to a small market and become a broadcaster at like a small, tiny little news station. Cause like I had a little reel that I had made during college from broadcasting of me being an anchor, doing like, you know, entertainment stuff, like movie reviews, and then doing some sports broadcasting. So I had like a nice little reel that I had put together. So like I was going to send that out and just like, you know, go out into the world and see what happened.
Why 3 months?
I don't know. I just thought that if like 3 months was should be enough time for me to get some sort of job in film or video, right?
How old are you at this time?
I was 22, maybe 23.
Yeah, that sounds like a 22-year-old idea.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to give myself 3 months, and in 3 months, if I don't make it, I'm done.
Yeah, but I was like, that should be enough time, and then I'll go do this and start that path. So basically, after like 2.5 months, I found a job on Craigslist for a first assistant director on a feature film. And so I went and I interviewed for that. And
how many people did they interview for that?
I think like 3 or 4. And one of the guys who I interviewed with, I'm still in who there's a couple guys who they ended up not choosing, and I still am in contact with those guys, which is funny. And they're still out here doing different things. But so I got it. And the deal was, it was a 55-day shoot. 55-day shoot.
Holy crap.
And 2 weeks of prep. And it was for a flat rate of $2,500.
Oh my gosh.
So I took it. And, yeah, it was crazy, crazy low. So I worked for 2 weeks location scouting and working with the team. And then we shot for 55 days. They weren't always 12-hour days. Sometimes they were shorter days, but yeah, it was just nonstop craziness. And oddly enough, guess who was the DP on that movie?
Jason Josepher.
James Laxton, who just shot Moonlight.
No way.
Yeah, way. So at the time, he was like just I think he had shot maybe 2 or 3 movies, and he had shot this director's first movie. And so this was his second movie, and he somehow this director had convinced James to come back and shoot his second movie. And we shot on the red one.
Okay, hold on 1 second. What was the budget of this movie? Do you know?
They never told me, but I think it was over $500,000.
Really? That much? Because I was going to say, like, all right, now this goes to Lindsay and Manny's point.
They spent They spent so much money. I don't know how much James got paid. I'm sure he got paid way more than I did, obviously. But they spent a lot of money in areas that they probably shouldn't have spent money on. And they bought a lot of crazy ass things. Like they had a crystal sword made because it was an action movie. It was like an action Bollywood, drama movie. It was just the craziest thing. And we shot all over.
Can we see this
over.
Movie anywhere?
Yeah, it's online. I'll post the link. It's called okay. Karma. He turns blue, kind of like a Super Saiyan at some point.
Dude, a job to have right out of college. Like a 55-day shoot as a first AD. You must have learned a ton.
I learned so much. And James was really great. Like he really taught me a lot because like he was like the professional link to for me to the professional world. And he like showed me like what a call sheet really looked like. He like talked to me through schedules. I remember having long conversations with him. And he used to say like, he said something like, you know, this isn't, you know, this might be your first movie, but it's not going to be any of our last movie. It's just a movie. We're going to get through it. Don't worry. Just blah, 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 you know, and like, cause I had to come up with a schedule. I had to come up with all this stuff. And, you know, like I remember the first day, like I hadn't thought about where people were going to park and where the bathrooms were I remember the first day we shot it at, you know, at Berkeley campus at the International Cafe or International House or whatever. And I was like, where the fuck? I was like, oh my God. Like I didn't include parking on the call sheet or on my email. And I hadn't included thought of where people were going to go to the bathroom. Luckily they had bathrooms at the International House for us to use. But like after that day, I was like making sure to ask every place, like, is there bathrooms? Where are they going to park? And getting those two things down. So I like learned a lot in that process. And then just, you know, yeah, I mean, I basically ended up producing that movie, but they gave me a line producer credit and a first AD credit, but they wouldn't give me a producer credit, even though James was like, he made a big case to the director to like give me a producer credit. But then they were basically like, well, in Bollywood, if you don't put money into the movie, then you can't be a producer. And I was like, I'll give you 25 bucks, like whatever. And then they just didn't want me to be a producer on it, basically.
Do you remember what your overhead was at this level in your life? Like the $2,500 had to last you 2 months. Was that enough?
I mean, barely. I mean, I basically left my job at LensCrafters, and I just didn't show up for my shifts, and I didn't really tell them. I was like, oh, I'm gone. I was so busy, like I didn't even care. And then I just stopped bouncing for a while. So I kind of had some money left over from LensCrafters. I had a lot of debt too, but yeah, it just barely was enough. And then it was so funny, like through that job, like we shot at a winery. And they needed a video. And so I basically, like, while, like, doing that, I kind of negotiated, like, to use their winery. I negotiated also to, like, you know, do a video for them. So, like, they still paid me to do this video, but I gave them a discount on the video that I would shoot for them to do, let us shoot there. And that's kind of how I met that winery. And then they've been a returning client. I just did a video for the video series for them last year. So oh, wow. It's kind of funny that like my first professional video client also came from my first job on this little low budget independent film.
That's
that
amazing.
Was crazy. Yeah. But yeah, it was, that was, so that were was
you,
crazy.
Were you living on your own at the time?
No, I had two roommates. So yeah, I was still
like, but you weren't still with your parents.
No. I had been outside living with my roommates, you know, by us of state for like 3 years or 2 years at that point. So yeah, I was already on my own out of the house. So that movie finished, and then I immediately after got a job as a key PA on a big budget Bollywood movie that was shooting in town for 30 days. So then I did that whole thing, and that was really crazy because there was like half Bay Area professionals and half Indian professionals from India, you know, like Bollywood professionals who flew out here. And we had the biggest Bollywood star in the world. Shahrukh Khan. Gosh, I can't remember his name. But yeah, he's like the Tom Cruise, Will Smith, and Tom Hanks, all rolled into one. Basically, he's like the biggest Indian star.
So and that how'd was you like, find this job?
Craigslist.
Wow, Craigslist. Craigslist yeah. Connecting people since 2000.
I know. So like, I learned a ton about that. I worked a lot with the locations manager on that movie. So that's kind of like how I got a lot of the skills of, you know, doing the location stuff. And like, I did tons of locations on the movie before that. So like, you know, those two projects together kind of gave me my location space. And then when that movie was done, I basically just started getting some PA jobs. You know, I worked on Amazing Race. I worked on, Extreme Makeover Home Edition. I worked on Trauma for a handful of days. It was a TV show.
This is all still through Craigslist?
So the Trauma one is hilarious. So I knew about them shooting in the Bay Area, and I knew it was happening. And I had thought to myself, like, I had worked on this movie, I'd worked on that movie. I was like, if I can't get on Trauma, I basically don't deserve to work as a filmmaker, as a professional in the Bay Area. Like, I should be able to at least become a PA on Trauma. So one day I hear from my friend who's he does AMR. He's like a ambulance chaser guy, or not ambulance chaser, but he worked on an ambulance. He heard that they were shooting by our house. And so me and my roommates went over to watch the shoot, and we're sitting there. And then one of the stand-ins is somebody I know from another movie that I helped my friend Isaac on. He was the star of Isaac's movie, was there standing in for these professional actors on this big Hollywood set. And so I say hello to him and we're chatting. And then I ask him who the PAs are, and he points me out the PAs sitting around. And then before we leave, I go over and I say, hey, man, I just want to introduce myself. I'm Ulrich. I'm a PA in the Bay Area. You know, I'd love a job if you guys need any extra help on this thing. And he's like, you know, gave me his number. I called him, and I was working there next week on Trauma.
Look at you making it happen.
So that's how I got my first, like, professional PA job, really. And I can't remember how I got the other ones, like working on – I think the Amazing Race and the other things, that happened after working on Trauma. I think Trauma was the start of my professional PA life.
How long out of college is this?
The fall. So I had worked on, maybe eight, 9 months after, or that's like late summer. So I had worked on the movie, the first low budget one in April and May, basically March, April, May. And then I got the job on the other one in June. So that was all of June. And then it was July. I was like sort of like trying to find whatever I could. I was like calling people out of, the phone book or the Reel Directory, which we just worked with a guy who publishes the Reel Directory, oddly enough. So that's funny. Doug, our production designer. So I used the Reel Directory and I did a lot of cold calling. That's kind of how I led to some of my jobs. And then, you know, eventually I got that opportunity on Trauma randomly. And then I got the internship at Studio B around the same time. And then I basically had to choose between working at Studio B or like doing the PA game. And since Studio B offered the ability to like learn all this like fancy equipment, like learn how to use the Red, learn how to do sound, I got to shoot on like, you know, an Adobe commercial, like on my first 2 weeks or whatever. So it was like all those things like made Studio B a better place to be than like doing the PA thing. So I basically had to turn down a bunch of days on Trauma to do Studio B, and then they just stopped calling me for the PA jobs. But I think in the end that was the better choice because that led to so many other things down the line.
How long did you do the Studio B thing before you went freelance?
Well, I was freelancing when I was at Studio B because I was just working like a few days a week. But I like had to give them like, I think it was like 2 or 3 days a week. I had to be there as an intern doing like working for $75 a day as an intern. If I got booked on their jobs, I had to turn down the PA jobs. So I was trying to do PAing and the Studio B thing at the same time, but it just wasn't working out that well. So that's why I kind of had to turn down lots of the Trauma days. But then after the internship was over, they offered me the ability to work as a assistant. Basically same deal. Like I think they gave me 1 to 2 days promised in office a week at $200 a day. And then, if they had shoots, I would go on the shoots as an assistant for the same rate. And that was better than my PA rate I was getting was like minimum wage. It was like $125 a day. So that was better in a lot of ways. And then I did that for a year. And then I think at the end of that year, that's when I worked on, the Francis Ford Coppola movie, which came from a connection from my first internship at ABC7. That's how I got that job. And then when that one ended, my boss at Studio B quit. And then I got offered the full-time manager role there. So then I was there for 2 years as the manager, the Reynolds manager. And then when I quit was when I made Strange Thing, and I finally quit to pursue my life as a filmmaker and be a freelancer.
And that's around when we met.
And we met a year after that, I think.
Year after that.
Or maybe 2 years after that.
Maybe, yeah.
Something around there. Yeah. Because I left in 2013 in January. That's when I left Studio B. And that was a year of post on Strange Thing before that was done that fall. And then the spring after that was when I did all the running around with the film festivals. And I think when I got back from that, that fall is when we met. So crazy.
So RC says, my constant worry is not knowing exactly what to do next. Do you think that he or she needs to worry?
No, I just say go out and find whatever job you can that's related to what you want to do and learn and just go for it. And I mean, it's funny that Timothy, you didn't do that. You just got a day job and you took your time to get to where you were going to be. But like, I don't know. I think both ways work, but I think whatever you want, like you just visualize what you want and visualize the way to go after what you want. Cause that, like, I believe in visualization a lot. Like I remember before that trauma thing, I was like, when I just heard that it was shooting in town, I was like, I can't believe I'm not working on this. I need to be working on this movie. I like visualized working on trauma that like, yes, I will work on trauma. It will happen. And then it did. But I mean, I made it happen by putting myself in that position and asking the right questions and putting myself out there. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what it takes is I think it's a visualization and then going after it. So I don't know. I say like just, you know, if you want to make movies, you know, it's so stupid, but it's so true, you know.
Well, I think the point for me is you can make movies from anywhere. Like I was working 9-to-5 jobs and like I was started to make movies when I was working at facilities. I wasn't a producer. I didn't have any connections. I wasn't using production resources from my agency to make my movies. I was just using my friends. Like there's just a handful of people that I was friends with at the agency, like that were receptionists and working in like different departments that all wanted to make movies that had no connection to the production industry. And we were just like, let's make movies. And so we just did. And like, to me, it was the same as if I worked at any company. And it didn't have to be advertising. I wasn't able to tap into those resources until years later when I got into the production department.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, yeah, I just think for me, I've lived my life this way. Like I've just said yes to opportunities, you know, and that's kind of how we became friends too.
Right. That's what Ulrich always does. Yes.
Yeah, he just says yes. No problem. So I think like just saying yes to things. And if you're not sure, yeah, like it's only going to be like, just figure out how much time it's going to take from your life. Like it's going to be, oh, is it going to be a week, 2 weeks? Just think whatever you're giving up to do that thing that's going to take 1 or 2 weeks, like you can just do it when you get back after that 1 to 2 weeks. So I don't know. I think just say yes. But I mean, I know a lot of people would be like, no, you can't just say yes to everything. You got to be choosy. But I think, yeah, why not? Just say yes.
I'm more of the choosy person. I've said no to a lot of things.
Right. But yeah, and it's worked out well for you. So
I guess. I don't know. That could be argued.
Oh my God.
His other question is, how did you meet the right people to push your projects through?
Oh, so I was going to say, on that second movie I worked on as a key PA, so guess who was the driver for the director on that movie, Timothy?
Michael Bay.
Matt Stoop, my gaffer. So that's how I met Matt. And he came to set with his grip gloves on his belt, ready to jump in and help the grip and electrics, whatever they needed.
But he was a driver?
He just got stuck driving the director the whole time.
Oh, amazing.
And he was, because he was also a cabbie at the time. That was like one of the day jobs he did in between freelance jobs. So, that's why they gave him the job of driving the director. He's like, oh, you drive a cab professionally? Oh, you should drive the director then. You'll be great for that role. And so that's how we met on that movie. Years and years ago, like 7 years ago, I guess now. Or more, almost eight years ago. And so that's how we met. And then basically after that point, anything I ever needed a gaffer on, he was the first call. So like, even like when I was doing these really tiny little videos with like a 2-person crew, like he was part of the crew, like lighting it for me. And so he just will always be my first call for lighting for the rest of my career, you know, and it's based off of meeting him back on that movie, however long ago. So I don't know. I think that's how you meet people is like, you just you get on these projects, you get on these things and, you know, and like James Laxton, like he'll probably never shoot anything for me because he's too big time now. But like back then he was like, yeah, if you have a short film, I'll shoot it for you. You know, just let me know. But it just took me way too long to get ready to shoot my first short film. By the time I got it ready, he'd moved to LA. He'd gotten an agent and a manager and he was just too big time for me, you know? But like if I had you know, made the move fast enough, he probably would have DP'd my first movie.
Yeah.
And things would have been very different if I had acted faster. And I, knowing that now, it's like, Jesus, why didn't I do that? But, I don't know. It's just because, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to make that first jump to your first big, big short film, you know? Especially when you're around that world of being on sets and you want to do it a certain way. And like you've been on a movie where it's been done the wrong way. And like, you don't want your set to be like that at all. You want it to be a good set where everyone's happy with you at the end, not pissed off like so many projects you've worked on, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, the point is like, you look around the people that you're meeting and you just like start choosing the tribe. Like Lindsay and Manny were talking about this. You choose your tribe and you, the people you want to come up with, and you kind of build your crew around that. I didn't have the benefit of having crew to choose from because I wasn't working on that side of things. I was very disconnected from the production world. So a lot of the first crew that I used was just like friends that a lot of them had zero experience, and I was putting them in roles they never should have done. And then when I got over that, then I started like finding people like through the Reel directory, or just like cold calling. Like I cold called the DP that shot Man's Best Friend. We just like contacted the first person, Art Adams, at the top of the list. Be like, hey, Art, are you interested in doing a short film for us? And then he jumped on.
Wow.
I started meeting crew only as a result of shooting stuff. Shooting short films as a director, but I didn't know anybody up until that point. So yeah. It's kind of like, even now I'm just meeting people for the first time. Like every single crew that I've worked with has been different because I'm just not tapped into the production community at all. And I'm just working with people for the first time because, somebody knows them. Like I meet somebody like you, and then you introduce me to people, and I'm like, you know, going, my network's expanding in a very different way than yours is.
Yeah, but it's also like you being on the agency side, it allowed you to be able to raise $100,000 for your short film, where like right. I don't think I could do that from my position, but I have like a lot of crew connections, like I can get all the crew people together. But
right.
Raising the money is a different thing for me, you know.
So yeah, it's interesting how we both have different ways of going about it, and there's pros and cons to both of them. And like, I just, anyone out there that's trying to figure out what their path is, like, just get on a path, and then once you're on it, like, look around and see what you have available to you and make the most of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think we should stop it. This is an hour and 40 minutes of episode.
We'll cut it down.
You'll cut down.
I think I can cut down a lot of the opening stuff about our production. I don't know how interesting that is to anyone but us.
Sure, sure. Okay.
We'll see.
Awesome.
Otherwise, it'll just be an extra long episode.
Yeah.
People love that.
And I don't remember if I talked about it at all, but I really need to talk about it because I made it like, you know, a month ago now or more. This short film that I shot in a day, Cake, that I made for $100. It was 6 hours and, you know, whatever. Do I talk about this on the podcast? Do you remember?
I don't know if you did. I don't remember.
So I was taking this Werner Herzog masterclass. I think I took 5 lessons of it or something. And one of the assignments was to make a movie in under 10 hours with no money and just on an iPhone. So I shot out my C100. I had 2 actors. We shot for 3 hours, and then I edited for, I think, 4 to 5 hours. And the movie's done. It's been online for a while. It's got over 2,000 hits on Facebook. I think it's got like nothing on Vimeo, but you guys should watch it. And Lindsay, this is me making a movie with no money and no budget. This is me fulfilling the challenge that you gave us. So here you go. And I hope to do more of these. This was like my plan before I got this big job. I was like, yeah, I'm just going to make movie after movie after movie and just churn out shorts, shoot them on the weekend, low budget, no crew, whatever, whatever, like get better at being like, you know, down and dirty. And then, yeah, I did this project, and now it's like, okay, now I've got to get back to it again. But
I remember when you made Brother, you told me you're going to make a movie every month.
Yeah.
Cause like
I got inspired by this company out of Texas that did that. But yeah, maybe I don't know if I can do that now, but at least I'll make a couple more of these like really fun little shorts and just see what happens. I want to collaborate with people. So if anyone has an idea for like a short that they can make within a day with no money, send it to me. I'd love to direct it for you. Okay. Anything else you want to talk about, or should we go out of this?
Let's get out of this.
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for listening. You can check out our website at makingmoviesishard.com, where you can find the links to the things we talked about on this episode. You know, some of our old short films, the features I worked on. Timothy's, do you want to put your old shorts on? Or no, you don't
sure,
care about that.
Why not?
All right, whatever. You'll do it. If you want to get in contact with us, send us an email to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. And if you have a topic suggestion or a question, we'll share it on the show. Or if you just want to talk to us about something offline, we'll do that too. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at MMIH Podcast. And please, if you like the show, tell a friend, help us to get the word out. You can leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher like these wonderful people did. And yeah, we'll shout it out on the show. And we really appreciate every review, every comment, every anything. So thanks, guys, for paying attention and listening and giving us feedback. Really love it.
And you guys are the best.
Yeah, you guys are the best listeners. I just jumped on Twitter today after the first time and saw all these comments on the Jackie Dallas episode. So that made me really happy and glad people like that. So yeah, thanks, man, for an awesome episode. And thanks. I got to thank you personally for bringing me on this job, because it's one of the best experiences of my life. And I think it's like really brought my game up. So
oh, awesome. Thank you. I'm so glad it happened. Like this, the team was much better as a result of you being part of it. Aww. So I was happy to have you.
Thanks, man.
You kidding? And I'm glad that they're already going to hire you for another job. That makes me feel really good.
Things like there's going to be exciting things to come in the future, with this company and the, you know, the team. So I'm really excited that I'm get to be a part of it. So it's so much fun.
Yeah, everyone stay tuned.
Stay tuned. All right. Talk to you guys next week.